Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Help TVO create a better world through the power of learning. Visit TVO.org and make a tax-deductible donation today.
Jane Philpott has seen firsthand how our healthcare system works and doesn't work, both as a family physician and as a former federal minister of health. Now she has a new book that offers solutions for our ailing system. It's called Health for All, a doctor's prescription for a healthier Canada. She is also dean of the Faculty of Health Sciences at Queen's University, and she joins us now for more. It's great to see you here.
Nice to be here.
It's a bit of a haul from Kingston to drive all the way. We're grateful.
Always happy to come see you.
Thank you for saying so. You write in the introduction to your book, our health systems suffer from arrested development. What does that mean?
Well, it means that we started off really well. Way back in the 40s and 50s and 60s of the last generation, we did some really great things. Tommy Douglas and others decided that we should have insurance for everybody so their hospital care would be covered. And then later they decided we should make sure everybody has insurance for doctor care. And that started in Saskatchewan, was affirmed across the country. Monique Bejean did some great work to wrap all that together in 1984.
With the Canada Health Act.
With the Canada Health Act. And then we stopped. Even though those founders of Medicare always dreamed that it would go beyond just doctors that was guaranteed and beyond hospitals, that it would include things like home care and mental health care. But we essentially rested on our laurels and said what we had done was pretty awesome, and it is. So it's not nothing, but it never actually finished developing.
Well, you said one thing in this book, and I thought, don't we already have this? You said universal primary care is something we should have in Canada. And as I say, I thought, wait a sec, we have that, don't we? We don't, eh?
We do not have that. And you're not alone in thinking that we have that, because we've always thought, well, everyone can get doctor care, but the reality is everyone can't. Because, in fact, we know now from studies that have been done in the last year or so measuring access to family doctors that there's about 22% of Canadian adults that don't have a family doctor or any other place to go to get primary care. And it happened almost without us knowing it, like the frog in the pot that gets boiled up until you realize that you're in a bit of a crisis and no one was paying attention.
It's like a bunch of folks my age, a bunch of family docs my age just retired, and suddenly 2 million people in Ontario don't have a family doctor.
Retirement is a big part of it. It's the supply side as well. Mm-hmm. It's people leaving and going into specialized areas, but it's certainly reached a crisis point.
You know, I got to tell you, one of the reasons I really liked your book so much was not just the prescriptive part of it, but also because I've known you since you first got into public. Actually, I met you before you got into public life.
But there's
a lot in here I didn't know about you. And with your, well, you've written about it, so I'm not going to ask your permission. I'm just going here. How much of your wanting to be a family doctor was because of what happened to your brother, Gary? And maybe you should explain that to people as well.
Well, thank you for asking that, Steve. And I do, it's in the chapter where I talk about being a family doctor that I describe the family doctor of my childhood, the first one I remember, and how he did house calls for us, which was an amazing thing that very few family doctors do anymore. And the reason that really mattered a lot to me and to our family was that we had a very tragic death of my brother, who was just a year or so older than me. He was 6.5 years old. We were living in Winnipeg at the time. There was a big influenza outbreak in Winnipeg, and he became sick one day, and a few days later ended up in Winnipeg Hospital and died within days of his illness coming on. And it was obviously incredibly hard on my mom, especially. And I always felt when our family doctor came over to visit or when we went to see our family doctor that it really mattered a lot to my mom that she knew that there was someone that was looking out for her and looking out for the kids. And so I think that while I didn't realize it at the time and almost didn't realize it until I reflected on it in writing the book, that 2 decades after my brother died, I was a family doctor myself. And I'm sure that what happened to him had more of an impact than I've ever realized.
Another part of this book that was incredibly hard to read is the fact that that is not your only family tragedy. 1991, you're in Niger in Africa, you're working for Médecins Sans Frontières, and your two-year-old daughter, Emily, dies. And despite that unbearable pain, you offer up this perspective. Sheldon, bring this graphic up if you would. At that time in Niger, almost 3 out of every 10 babies born would not live to see their 5th birthday. It seemed almost every Nigerian woman I knew had experienced the death of at least one of her children. Our loss was profound, but we were not special. We had entered into a new bond with our friends and colleagues. We were newly united in grief. Okay, so many things to ask about this. First of all, did you get to a point where you thought to yourself, God, what are you doing to my family?
I will say, and I don't think I say this in the book, that immediately after our beautiful little girl died from meningococcemia, and even the day after, my sentiment was, get me out of this country and I never want to come back. It was so horrific that one day this lovely little toddler was bouncing around playing and the next day she was dead. But it was actually people in the village that came to greet me, and it was confronting those incredibly compassionate people who lived in this village in rural Niger, who came to give us comfort and to shake our hands and to tell us to be patient. And as I heard them say that to me and realized what they had been through, which was so much worse than I had ever been through, despite our loss, that I thought, I do need to be patient. I don't want to go away. I want to keep working and doing this health work so that someday maybe 27% of kids in Niger we would not see those kind of statistics of the number of children who don't live to see their 5th birthday. And I'm happy to say that over the years, while things are still pretty grim for healthcare in Niger, that things have gotten better there.
Okay, except that your other child at the time almost died as well. And so I'm going to come back to it again. I mean, part of the reason I'm asking you this is you're very open about this in the book. You're a very rare bird in as much as in academia, in politics, in much of society today, we're not that religious anymore. And you still are. And you've been put to hell and back, right? Like, you've gone to hell and back with some of the stuff you and your family have had to deal with. How do you make sense of any of that?
Well, thank you for saying that, Steve. But, you know, the reality is we all have pain in our lives. I mean, we have to not pretend that life is not going to deal us some nasty blows that we don't deserve that happen just because of all kinds of things that are beyond our control. And so these were huge tragedies, but I think that through the teachings of other people and through my faith, we found that the way that you find meaning in those tragedies is to say, what does that teach me about what I can do for others and potentially help somebody else from not having to go through what I had to go through, and or comfort others who have gone through those things. And so I do talk in the book a lot about faith and hope and meaning as ways to be well and things that we probably should talk more about in society.
When you hear people complaining about the weather, do you want to smack them upside the head?
Well, people will always be people, but, you know, you do get a lot of perspective when you've, and people in healthcare, I'm not the only one that gets perspective. When you see tragedy, you realize that sometimes we do need to be thankful for the simple things.
Okay, let's get back on the path here of talking about your prescriptions for healthcare. And again, you have this line, ill health anywhere is a threat to wellness everywhere. Again, what does that mean?
Well, I talk a lot in the book about the idea of interdependent wellness and that we have to take care of one another. And in fact, you know, in the early days of COVID, I'm sure you remember like I do, we really understood that. You know, we looked out for each other and we all made sure that we sheltered and followed all the rules and made sure that we cared for ourselves and prevented ourselves from getting sick so that we wouldn't infect others. Unfortunately, that sentiment isn't as strong as it was in those days. And right now, when the healthcare system is in such crisis, there's a real sense of maybe I'll just look out for myself. Maybe I'm actually not going to worry about making sure that the country has everything that it needs. And if I want to jump the queue and spend lots of money to go and get my needs cared for, then that's not such a bad thing. But the truth of the matter is that it does actually affect everyone if we don't develop a system where everyone has access to care. In an infectious disease, that's obvious. If you don't treat the people who've got tuberculosis or whatever it might be, then you're at risk that it will spread to others. But it's also in the way that we set up a system in this country so that people will get access to care based on their medical need and not based on their ability to pay. And if we don't do that, it's going to impact the rest of society because those people will eventually need care. And if we don't treat them when they need it, it will cost us all more in the end.
Some of us 4 years ago did a little better at taking care of each other than others. And I want to put on the record right here, right now, that there was a long-term care home in Toronto that was absolutely disintegrating. And it was in such bad condition, there were employees who, I guess understandably, wouldn't go to work anymore because they thought they were going to die. And Jane Philpott showed up, she put on the PPE, and you went in there and got things under control. And you don't have to say anything, but I just want that on the record right now while we're talking about this. Okay, you want every person living in Canada to have a primary care home. What does that mean?
We talked earlier about family doctors and the fact that, ideally people want to have a family doctor with whom they can have a longitudinal relationship over time who will be there for them every day that they need it and provide them the care they need, which is a dream that's wonderful. The reality is that's almost impossible to do right now. But what we can do is actually put family doctors in teams where they work with nurse practitioners and nurses and dietitians and physiotherapists.
I thought that was all happening already.
It's only happening for a small proportion of the population. So here in Ontario, only about 25% of the people of Ontario have access to what we call a family health team. It was a fantastic innovation that came in about 20 years ago when they were first introduced, and it started to roll out. Turns out that the people that got into family health teams tended to be the people who were relatively advantaged socially writ large. And for a number of reasons, not all of which are entirely clear to me, that was stopped. And now...
Because they're expensive.
Well, they are perceived to be expensive at first because it does cost more than just a single doctor setting up shop, but it saves money down the road. So here's where we need to get smart about making sure that everyone has a primary care home, because if you put that investment in up front, spend a little bit more on primary care than we do in Canada, which is actually a very small amount, then you can actually detect illnesses early on and you can care for people for their high blood pressure or diabetes early on so that they don't end up needing the expensive forms of care when they get cancer or cardiovascular disease because we've left it too late.
Absolutely. Except I've been hearing health ministers, and you used to be one of them, saying that for 45 years. They all know that's what we have to do, but it seems to me that we can't get from here to there. So how do we get from here to there?
I'm glad you asked. And it was actually one of the inspirations to write the book was that I had a bit of an aha moment, having come out of government and sort of seeing, you know, how do you move those levers within government, which it's not always obvious how that works. But I realized that what we had done well with the Canada Health Act was we set some principles or standards for what we wanted to happen, and the federal government gave money to the provinces, and they made sure that we held to those principles for the most part. It hasn't been perfect, but it's been pretty good. What if we set those similar kinds of standards in law, in federal law, to say every Canadian has the right to a primary care home that is publicly funded, where they have a team who provides care that's accessible and integrated into the rest of the system? So I propose in the book something that I call the Canada Primary Care Act, because I agree with you. I'm not the first person that's talked about universal access to primary care, but we've been stuck. We've never figured out how to make that policy proposal into a reality. I believe we need to put it in law. That's what many other countries have done and been successful. And that will force us to get our act together and make it happen.
Well, would it? Because governments have a habit of passing laws and that, you know, that apply to us, but not necessarily to them. What happens if you pass this law, a government does not follow the law? What are the punishments?
Well, you'd have to look to international examples of how it works well. And I talk a little bit about this in the book, where countries have really done well. A place like Norway, where more than somewhere between 95 and 99% of people have a primary care home, and they actually have a list of everybody in the country, and they know exactly what primary care home that they're attached to.
Small population, very homogeneous compared to us.
Okay, right. Let's go to the UK then.
All right.
And you're going to tell me that geography is entirely different to Canada.
Well, so, it is.
You know, there are lots of reasons why one thinks it might not apply. But these mm-hmm. countries have figured it out, and it works pretty well. And when you move to a country like that, you put your postal code into the website and it says your primary care home is on the corner a block or two away. And if you move to another town, you actually can get a primary care home there. It's a little bit like we do with public schools, where we mm-hmm. build a system and make sure everyone has access. Why can't we do that?
Well, okay, you're asking me, and now I'm going to tell you, because we don't have a healthcare system. We have a sickness treatment system.
You're here.
We don't have a system where we try to keep you healthy so you don't need to go to hospital. We have a system that seems to put all of its accent on treating you once you're already sick. So if that's going to be the emphasis, then we're never going to get to Jerusalem, are we?
Well, we need to do the upfront work of making sure that we establish in law a right to primary care. The feds will support the provinces. They'll sit down together and agree that this is what Canadians want and need. I hope my book will help to inspire them to imagine what's possible. And we can do this.
You have a quote in here from former Prime Minister Paul Martin, which I love and which I've heard him say numerous times. But I wonder if it's still true. He said to you, I guess, you can do more in 10 minutes at the cabinet table for the things you believe in than you can advocating from outside in 10 years. You've been there. Is that true?
It's totally true.
It is, eh?
It is
still
true. It is still true. I can tell you there are things that I was able to do that saved literally thousands of lives. I mean, I had the incredible privilege of being the health minister who said naloxone should be available without a prescription. When I started in 2015, you had to have a prescription. And there are tens of thousands, if not more, perhaps hundreds of thousands of people who have had an overdose reversed by a naloxone kit that was available without a prescription. And some of those people would not be alive today if they'd had to have had a prescription for that. I was able to do that by a decision that I made as a minister in probably about 10 minutes thinking.
And you were minister for less than 2 years. Imagine if you'd been there for longer. What else could you have done?
Oh, I mean, it's an incredible privilege to be in politics and to be able to make those decisions. I mean, the reason that people are sick and the reason that people are well is often due to the way that society has established itself. And one of the things that attracted me to politics was, you know, someone set up the rules of society so that it works this way. It's not working so well for everybody. So who made those rules, and how can I get to be the person that changes the rules? And that's the thrill of being able to use politics to make people healthier, and it is pretty awesome.
I do want to circle back to that notion of faith and religion, because you know, in politics, unless you're a social conservative, and there are some, but in most of the parties, most of the members of parliament and most of the people who work in and around Parliament Hill are not people of faith anymore. I think that's fair to say. Same in academia, certainly probably worse in academia, right? There's even fewer God-fearing people in academia. Did you feel like a fish out of water? Do you in your academic setting? Did you in your political setting?
I think that there are more people who have faith in a higher power of some sort than we realize. But we have become such a secularized society, and it has become a taboo topic. You know, don't talk to people about religion, or some people would say politics. But that's not to say that people don't have faith, that they don't examine how did we all get here and who created all this beautiful nature around us and what happens after we die. Those are questions that every human being asks at some point. And for some reason in politics, it's been one of those things that you just don't talk about. But when we don't talk about these really deep heartfelt issues and values, there's something missing. And I actually think it takes away not just from individual wellness, but from societal wellness if we can't learn how to talk together about the things that matter the most to us.
Because I'm betting there was never a moment when you were at the cabinet table when you said, you know, God will not take kindly to the decision we are making here today. Am I right? Like, you just can't go there.
You can't and you shouldn't. You know, just because the person has personal faith, the things that you believe, the things that you value, it's not our role as doctors or politicians to impose those values on others, but they can guide our own personal decision making, and we can share them from the point of view of what we believe. But it's not something that's intended to be part of a decision making toolkit.
I'm back in the book now. Sheldon, if you would, top of page 4, let's bring this quote up, if you would. I don't know, Jane Philpott writes, I don't know if I'll ever end up in politics again. But I do have political dreams. I dream of a culture of politics that is healthier and kinder. I dream of the country's leaders being consumed by the pursuit of a fairer Canada and a fairer world. I dream that Canadians will not surrender to the easy path of divisiveness where people are sorted into us and them. I dream Canada will be led up a harder path, one where we stick together and look out for the interests of one another. This is a kind of another one of those, boy, that sounds good, but it sure seems impossible to get from here to there. Is it?
It can't be impossible. We have to be able to figure this out. Canada is too important for us to tear ourselves apart the way we've been doing lately. And so I really do dream of a healthier politics. I think we're in a bad place right now for all sorts of reasons. And people are not impressed with that style of politics. I don't think anybody of any partisan stripe likes it, but we've sort of let ourselves deteriorate into this way that we treat one another. And I believe we can have a healthier politics. Maybe we need different kinds of people that are part of it. But we've got to pull together and be a country, and we've got to find a way to look out for one another, because what we would give up is too much to let go of.
Okay, so you use the words what we give up, and that it's a beauty. You led me with a beautiful segue to the next question, which is you famously resigned from politics, well, from cabinet, in sympathy with Jody Wilson-Raybould, your cabinet colleague, who was going through her own mishigas with the prime minister at the time, And I guess I wonder whether you ever have those nights where you think to yourself, you know, I can't have the time back, but had I not done that, I might still be there doing a lot of good for a lot of people. What do you think?
Oh, that's a tough one. You know, sometimes things happen for a reason and, you know, you don't always understand it at the time. There are times I feel really sad that I'm not there, because it was an exceptionally privileged and wonderful place to be and to work. But I've gotten to do some really terrific things with my team at Queen's University, where we've been able to have an impact on the healthcare system. And I've been able to think about the Canada Primary Care Act and write it all out in a book. So, you know, perhaps this was the way things were meant to turn out. And no matter what ends up happening, if you have a goal that you've set, and for me it's to improve people's health, you get one door closed in your face and you look for another door that opens.
Have you put this book in the hands of the current health minister, Mark Holland?
I have sent a copy to him. I don't know if he's received it yet, but I hope he reads it.
If he were sitting on that side of the table right there, and if he had read the book, go ahead, what would you say to him?
I would say, first of all, thank you very much for reading the book. I'm thrilled when anyone has said that they have. Please consider the recommendations that are in this book. We can be a country where everyone has access to a primary care home. You don't need to take my advice. There are many other colleagues that I could direct you to, but please talk to them and do the work to make it happen.
I love the way you're looking over there.
I'm pretending
you're visualizing him. I can tell. That's great. Jane Philpott, it's a great read, Health for All, A Doctor's Prescription for a Healthier Canada. Thank you for the book and your service to Canada, if I can put it that way as well.
Well, likewise, back at you.
The Agenda with Steve Paikin is made possible through generous philanthropic contributions from viewers like you. Thank you for supporting TVO's journalism.